Thanks. My name's Anthony. I'm an addict.
Hiya.
I always talk about how I'm feeling, and I'm feeling quite nervous. My stomach feels like a knot, and as the time's gone on, it's got tighter and tighter, and my chest feels quite tight, and I feel quite sick actually being here with the anxiety and all the faces staring at me. And it's just that paranoid fear. It's never gone away, it's got better, and I have recovered. But I've always got that fear that when I do a chair, I'm going to open myself up. And by opening myself up, I leave myself exposed to be exploited, or put down, or ridiculed, or judged, or criticised, or being rejected. The fear's never gone away. I've always had the fear of abandonment, that I'm not enough, that I'm completely worthless. And that's the lie that I live with. You know, I sit here, my head is off and up and running, it's screaming at me, and that's where my disease lives. It lives between my two ears. And it hasn't got a kind word to say anything about me or anyone else. I don't believe it. It talks in my voice, and I have to distinguish who's actually talking to me. You know, the disease that I walked in the door with 11 years ago is the same disease that I've got today. It hasn't gone anywhere. Its primary purpose is to maneuver me out the door and separate me from the fellowship, from my higher power, from my sponsor, from my sponsees, from any form of intimacy and relationship. Its primary purpose is to leave me on my own with my own thinking. My thinking is very, very distorted. You know, it was my birthday yesterday, and I've been in bed for 2 days, and I weren't going to come here today, and I thought I'd ride it out. You know, I was 11 years clean yesterday, and that's... You know, and that's a monumental achievement. But I've still got a disease that shames me. You know, the core of my illness is one of chronic shame, of never being enough, never belonging, never fitting in, always feeling quite insignificant and quite unlovable, and feeling quite flawed. I mean, my disease, you know, people say they get up before the disease. It's nonsense. Mine sleeps with me. Before I brush my teeth, it's telling me I've lost my hair, how much weight I've got around my waist. It tells me, you know, really derogatory things about myself, and sometimes it can be quite abusive, and the self-hatred actually kicks in. And sometimes I believe it. And where did my disease get the information? You know, I was misinformed by misinformed people as a child. I was told I was flawed. I was told I was insignificant. I was told I was an idiot. I was told I was stupid. I was told I was rubbish. I was told a lot of derogatory, a lot of people said a lot of derogatory things to me, and I believed them. I internalized them. And what it's done is attack my self-esteem, my self-worth, my self-belief, my conviction. I had none. I had no self-worth when I came here. I had no conviction, no confidence. But what I did have, I had loads of personas and masks. What I could do is I had a blind in front. And what it was like going to Harrods and opening the package, and there was nothing inside. But it had these lovely ribbons on the outside, and it was dressed up so well. You know, I could hide everything. But what I was hiding me, because I didn't like me. I despised what I saw, and I hated what I saw. And at the end of my using, I hated myself so much, all I wanted to do was die. My rock bottom, I don't know how long it lasted, but I just remember looking in the mirror, just hating and wanting to spit on myself, and having no love, because what I'd stopped valuing was the human being that was inside of me. I forgot I was a human being, and I felt like an obscenity at the end of my using, because I was desperate, and I had no hope. I'd spent many years in and out of institutions. I was enslaved to my thinking. I went along with it every time. And I always wound up in a very lonely place, a very dark, lonely place, cut off, alone, frightened, really, really scared, and not being able to connect with anything or anyone. My disease robbed me of my potential, and my creativity. People talk about dying. That's the death that I experienced. My spirit died. And within that, I couldn't be creative. I couldn't have any potential because the fear just crippled me. And I think what the recovery process started to do is started to unravel all that and give me insight and awareness. You know, somebody said to me when I came here, they said, go and look up the word addiction. You know, so I went and got a dictionary. I went and got a thesaurus, and it talked about being habitual, being obsessive, compulsive, to be enslaved, to give your all, to be a devotee. I was all of those things. I was prepared to compromise everything, including me. And somebody also said, go and look up the word cunning, baffling, and insidious, because all these words were just convoluted words to me. I didn't understand the language. I didn't know what people were talking about. And what it said, it talks about something that lies in wait, that is treacherous, something that wants to hoodwink and rob and deceive. And what it wants to rob me of is my life. It wants me in a place of being completely cut off, whether it be in a mental institution, whether it be in a prison, whether it be in a detox rehab. It just wants me cut off. And that's what I've always tried to do. I've tried to be completely cut off from my head. I've obliterated myself. I didn't want to get out of it. I just wanted to be completely unconscious. I didn't want to feel anything. All my life, I've never wanted to feel. You know, as a child, I felt so ugly. I felt so ugly as a child because everybody told me I was wrong. I was different. I didn't belong. I was obsessed. I felt dirty as a child. I hid as a child. And there weren't enough clothes and there weren't enough money that could hide me. The shame was on the outside because of who I am and where I come from. I come from, you know, my dad comes from the West Indies, my mum's Irish, and I was born in the 60s. And people used to spit at my mum and tell her some really nasty things about herself because of the person she was with. And I used to witness that, and then I used to experience that too. And I think what happened to me, I became a very angry child. Full of rage, full of hatred. I hated the fucking world. I'm sorry to swear. And I can feel it, you know, I can feel it. And I'm not saying that's the reason why I used, because I've got three brothers and none of them are used. I think, you know, being in a dysfunctional family, somebody has to act out the illness and somebody has to be the scapegoat, and it happened to be me. And what I've learned is this disease is so, so destructive. Because not only have I harmed me, I've harmed everybody I've come into contact with. You know, I've left a carnage of destruction behind me, a wake. The debris is emotional, spiritual, and psychological. And it's been to my children who have grown up, who I've never been there for, who I've had taken away because that was the best thing for them at that particular time. Because I couldn't meet their needs. I didn't know how to love myself, so how could I love my children? How could I give them any nurturing or any comfort or any emotional substance? You know, I didn't know what affection was. I didn't know what love was. I didn't know what care was. I didn't know what generosity was. I didn't know what any of those things were. To be kind, to be loving, to be tolerant, to be patient, to be considerate, to be thoughtful, to put myself into somebody else's shoes and to be on the receiving end of me. I didn't know what empathy was. All I could think about was me. This is the core of this illness is one of total self-centeredness. And that self-centeredness, as I said, this sickness lives between my two ears, not in the drugs. If I blame the drugs, I'll be in denial because I haven't used for 11 years and I've still got the disease. You know, the problem stares me every day in the mirror when I go and face it, me. I blamed everybody else. I blame my mum. I blame my father for walking out on me at two. I blame my mum for never being there, for never being emotionally holding, for being an addict to herself and being totally unavailable. And I always went to these cold places looking for warmth and desperately wanting love, and all I got was crumbs. And I blame the world because all I wanted to be was loved, but I hated myself. And I think my using was like liquid glue that held me together. I was so broken and fragmented, it just held me together. It saved my life because I would have killed myself at a very early age if I hadn't used, and then it became a problem. And the problem got out of control. The problem was every time I used, I went up in the same place. And I think if, you know, to talk about the steps, I think it's a good place to start. You know, when I use, I become a heathen. I have no morals, no boundaries, no values, none whatsoever. And anything that gets in front of me, I completely trash. But the sad part about that is the person that I trash the most is myself. And the place where I wind up the most is between four walls. I wind up imprisoned, enslaved to my thinking in my own head, and that's the prison. It doesn't always have to be a concrete wall where the walls are green and it's very dark and I'm standing on the end of the bed putting my hand out the window hoping that it's going to rain to feel the rain, because I know I'm not going to get out on the exercise yard. The imprisonment's living in oneself and being totally isolated and alone and desperately wanting to reach out and connect with someone. And this illness is about disconnection. And I've been so disconnected for such a long time. And what the recovery process has been about, it's been about having an intimate relationship with another human being. I've had the same sponsor for 11 years. And everything I've done, including my addict who's done it with me, has been to sabotage the relationship. Because it's like this small child desperately holding his hands out, wanting to be loved, but as soon as you get close to him, he kicks you in the shins. And I think what my sponsor's been, he's been unconditional. And he's taken me through the steps, and he's guided me, and he's always shared his experience. He's never told me what to do. He's always shared his experience. And what that's done, that's enabled me to grow and develop and become the person I am. Because as he took me through the steps, there was no judgment, there was no malice. There was no saying you got it wrong or got it right. It was about getting well. The recovery process is about getting well. I'm not here to be a good boy. I've done that. I've done the people pleasing. I've done the caretaking, being over responsible, wanting to be everyone's friend. I worked so hard at being good and I exploded with so much rage because the resentment had built up for so many years because I wanted to be such a good boy. And what my process has been, I've worked through the steps continuously because they don't stop. You know, my unmanageability, I could clearly see in my step one around the unmanageability, around the way I think, the way I thought about myself, what it was like when I put a chemical into my body, my powerlessness that once I started, I couldn't stop. I just could not stop. I desperately wanted to stop. I came to Narcotics Anonymous for 18 months, desperately wanting to stop. I could not stop. I used every day. I went over in toilets. I passed out in toilets. I woke up where I woke up. But I kept coming back, and somebody said, get smart feet. I could understand that. They said, keep coming back. You know, the anonymity, the spiritual foundations, all those big words, I didn't know what they meant, but they said, keep coming back. So I kept coming back, and all of a sudden, you know, things started to fall into place, and I looked at my insanity, and I looked at every time I used, I was insane, because I desperately wanted to kill myself when I used. And the way I looked at my insanity, I looked at all the harmful things I'd done to myself, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, and all the harmful things I'd done to other people that I desperately didn't want to do. And yet I kept picking up, and that was a form of insanity. Because I believed the lie that if I used, it would be different. I wouldn't cause all the same mistakes and all the same harm. But I did every time. And when I was working, you know, step three for me was a struggle. Because being an Irish Catholic, the thing around God was I hated God. And the God that I knew was very damning and very shaming and very persecutory. One that pointed the finger and one that pointed the finger at me all my life. Even growing up, I remember being 11, you know, I'm 11 years clean. When I was 11, I was shamed so much because I was me and I was discovering who I was as a young man, you know, grieving their adolescence and becoming a man and finding out about their sexuality. You know, I was shamed around that and I wasn't held or nurtured or supported in any way. I was just told I was going to burn in hell. You know, that was the damning thing I got from God, so my experience wasn't very good. But what my sponsor said, he said, it's about that thing what people say, there's two birds on a tree, they both make a decision to fly off to somewhere really hot. how many birds are left on the tree? Two. Because they both made a decision, none of them bothered taking any action. And what it was, he said, make a decision to work the oven 12 steps, you know, work all 12 steps. And that's what I did. I made a decision to work all 12 steps. And that was the commitment. You know, that was my commitment to hand my will and life over to a loving God and my understanding, something that was caring, kind and human, and that was going to be gentle. And what the step four process did for me, because the whole process of the steps isn't about the steps. It's about the relationship with another human being, the giving and receiving of love through the 12 steps. And that's what I didn't understand, because when I wrote my step four inventory, the first one, you know, I got a lot of insight. I saw that I felt insecure. I saw that I wanted to be so perfect to hide my core shame. I saw that I compensated in many different ways of caretaking, rescuing, fixing, being over responsible for other people, meeting everybody else's need, neglecting mine because yours was so important, because I was so fragile and I was so frightened of being left on my own. So I became this empty vessel, but on the outside, I just do anything for anyone to just be liked, to be loved, and not to be rejected. And I identified that in my full step because of the level of resentments. You know, my resentments are based on high expectations of people. I expect people to have such high qualities and values and morals and high expectations like myself, but I forget they're human, just like me. So, of course, expectations are like the mother of all disappointments. They lead to resentments. And what I had is a lot of resentments, quite a few, actually. And when I was taking my own inventory, one of the things that I noticed, the person that was there all the time was me. The one common denominator in all my resentments was me. And it weren't just about the resentments. It was about guilt. It was about shame. It was about disappointment. It was about hurt. It was about anger. It was about rage. It was like any unresolved left feelings that I've had that I haven't resolved. And it just weren't about all the negative feelings, which I'll come onto as well. But I just want to stay with those for a little while, because finding out about fear, you know, and what that actually means and how that paralyzes me and debilitates me, it empowered me, because being powerless is one thing and being empowered is another. You know, having insight, wisdom and knowledge is great, but it's what you do with it. Comes a great responsibility, and I had a great responsibility once I had that insight, because I could see that my fear was ruling my life. But the core of it was, what was behind it was the shame. And when I've done inventories, what I always see is the thing that always comes up is fear of being found out, fear of being a fraud. You know, that fear of just not being worthy. But what comes of it is defective behaviours of acting in a way that I'm either better than, I'm more superior, but what I really feel is less than and inferior, because I feel so inadequate. And as I said, all those masks and personas and canapes, they just take over, and I can be anyone you want me to be. I'm like a chameleon. And what I've had to do is I've had to let go of that, and I've had to be in my truth. And sometimes it's like being raw and naked, and it means you are exposed and you are vulnerable. And sometimes you feel oversensitive and you do take everything personal. Why not? I'm an addict. Why wouldn't I take everything personal? You know, but what I've also learned about taking an inventory is not about all my flaws. I'm not just a flawed person, and this is the key part of this. A self-appraisal is about looking at the good and bad parts of oneself. And what I've noticed is I've got some amazing qualities through the inventory process. Because even though I'm dominated by fear, I sat here, I had a lot of fear when I sat here. You know, I also had, based on the evidence of what I've seen over the time that I've been here, is that I've had a lot of courage. And that's based on the evidence. Where I come from, anything you say may be taken down and used against you at a later day is the evidence. That's the evidence for me. You know, I've seen it. You know, that if I work through something, I can come out the other side. You know, so I have fear, I have courage, and then it leads to faith. You know, I have envy, have jealousy, but what I have is admiration. I look at someone there and I admire what they do because I think, what did they do to get to that place? What have I got in me? Just before, I'd go straight to envy and jealousy, and then a nice resentment would kick in. You know, and my resentments are more about, as I said, I've understood that I set myself up in terms of the resentments. When I'm forgiven, you know, they dissipate, and I don't just forgive it. I have to do some work. And I think in learning to forgive, I have to understand, I have to have some empathy, I have to put myself in my mum's shoes. And this has been one of the core, it's been like my Achilles heel, my mum. You know, when I'd done the inventory process, I had to go and ask my mum lots of questions about what it was like for her as a child. And what I found out about my mum, because I'd never spoken to her. In 40 years, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, I'd never spoken to my mum in that depth till I was about 40 years of age. And what I found out was, you know, my mum at the age of 2 was left in an orphanage. Her mum left her there with 4 other girls, and then she went out and killed herself. And then my mum was brought up by nuns and priests, and she was traumatised with all sorts of levels of abuse, and she was never loved or nurtured, and she was given the best that was it. That was the best she was given. You know, that was all the love she was given. It wasn't enough. She desperately wanted more, but that's all she could pass on. And I didn't understand that at the time, but through asking the questions in the inventory process, what I was able to see was my mum is just as dysfunctional and damaged as I am. She's ill-equipped for life with the tools that she'd been given and what she'd passed on. And then I started to have some compassion for her because the level of hatred towards my mum was phenomenal. And what I've learned, you know, when I get to that place of anger with my mum, I have to work on the compassion. I have to work on the forgiveness. I have to work, you know, when I'm in a place of hate, I have to work on the love. You know, when I'm not understanding, I have to work on understanding. You know, when I'm intolerant around her, I have to be tolerant. You know, because I remember doing the first full step, and I just wanted to lay into my mum and tell her everything, what she'd done or what she hadn't done or what she hadn't been. I just wanted to tell her, you know, how my life was a mistake and how I shouldn't have been born, because that's how I felt about myself at that particular time. But my sponsor stopped me. You know, he said, just stay with the process and feel the feelings. Because what I'd never done, I'd been numb all my life. I'd never felt the feelings. And, you know, staying with that process, you know, a lot of healing has taken place. I think the steps are about healing. They're about life. They're about love. They're about healing. They're about warmth. They're about finding out the gentleness. Because I come from a place of total violence and destruction. You know, I think from 16 to 25, I think I spent 10 weeks out of a cell. You know, I was institutionalised for 20 years. You know, I've come into recovery. I've been out over 10 years, you know. Some people, I'm getting dry. Some people come into recovery, they have an overnight bag of baggage. My sponsor says it's really funny. But he said, you know, we come in with different levels of disturbances and problems, and I came in here with quite a lot of baggage, and I've had to work through it continuously. But what I'd like to say is, it's an equal opportunities disease. You know, it doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care whether you come from Park Lane or the park bench or what baggage you've got. You know, at the end of the day, it's the same thing. It's about destruction. As somebody said, you know, not to do the steps is at my own peril. Not to go back and look at my past is at my own peril. Because my past is my present. The way I think, because of my distorted thinking in my past, it does affect my present. And I have to change the way I think. You know, my first reaction is to be destructive. Very, very destructive. What recovery is about having the ability to respond. What I do is I react. So it's about practice. It's about practicing these principles in all our affairs. It's about practice, 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 practice. And what I've done is, since I've done the fourth and fifth step and I've shared it with another human being and I've been held and I've felt secure enough to share some, all my inventory, good and bad, and appreciate both, appreciate my qualities, appreciate my attributes, I felt more whole as a human being, because I'm not just one half that only looks out of one eye full of hatred and resentment and anger and fear and lust, envy and jealousy. I'm all of those things because I look out of both eyes, and I look out of one eye with love and compassion, forgiveness and empathy and understanding and tolerance and patience. And I've got so many qualities that I never knew that I had. One of the things is we start with the honesty, the open-mindedness and the willingness. We start with the perseverance. We keep coming back, and that gives us that commitment. I'm very committed. You know, I'm very willing. I'm very hard-working. You know, I'm very reliable and loyal. You know, I'm very generous. I never thought I was generous because I was an habitual thief. You know, I defrauded banks. You know, I sold drugs. You know, I go to work today. You know, I even sold drugs when I was in the nick. You know, it didn't matter. And it's like, what do I do today? I give as much as I can possibly give. Sometimes it's not enough. But I'm able to give and I'm able to receive. Through the process of giving, I'm receiving all the time by putting something else back on the table. Because where I come from, it's all about yourself. It's all about that place of being self-absorbed, self-indulgent, me, 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 me. And this is totally different. The other thing I learned from the inventory process was the beauty, was about magnificence, was about somebody's uniqueness, being able to love somebody unconditionally. You know, in my using, I lost my children. They're grown up now. They're 26, 22. You know, I'll talk a bit more about that in the amends steps. But what I've done as a father, I've become a father in recovery, and I've got two children. And what I see is, I see absolute beauty when I see those children in the morning. You know, I look in their eyes, and what I see is love, unconditional love. But I don't see the distortion. I don't see their ugliness, I don't see their flaws, I don't see their weaknesses or their limitations. The corruption hasn't started. The messages they're given haven't started. Because what I do is I affirm my children, something I couldn't do for myself. I affirm, you know, I'm very boundaried, I'm very clear, I'm very conscientious, but I'm loving, caring and kind. And I couldn't be like that with my other children. And that is the process of recovery, that I can wake up every morning and be there. Because I couldn't be there for anything or anybody. And what I've seen is the magnificence, not only in my children, and the beauty and the uniqueness, I can see that in other people. Because I can see it in myself, whereas before all I could see was something that I hated. And the change is slow. It's ongoing, it's a process. And the process has been, you know, part of that doing steps five and six, you know, having an understanding of what your shortcomings are. Because if I was to have my defects removed, I would more than likely be sectioned, because they're my feelings. It's what I do with them. You know, if I feel resentful towards you and I despise you, doesn't mean I have to talk about you behind your back or put you down or ridicule you or judge you or intimidate you. You know, that's the shortcoming. The process of recovery is staying with it. Just because I feel ill at ease with someone doesn't mean I have to go and slander them, lie about them. And that's the change. I've my feelings are my feelings. Someday I have ill feelings towards my wife. My wife, I'm not going to say they're going to go away, but she's still my wife. I'm married, and I speak, you know, I speak about them. I don't criticise. I just own my own feelings, what's going on, and I try not to react. You know, some days I have to get up and walk out the house and go for a walk or sit in the car and phone my sponsor, because what I want to do is react, but I know there's a consequence to my reaction, and there's a price tag to pay. You know, for me, the eighth step was so important, because what I had to look at in the eighth step, you know, the bridging steps were 6 and 7, because I had to continually write about my assets in step 7 and how I was responding. You know, I knew what my defects were, I knew what my assets were, and what I had to do was practice my assets more in my seventh step, so as I didn't come up short. And I think in the eighth step, what actually materialised for me was I was at that place where I could go and make the amends. And a lot of the amends for me have been about writing the person's name down, you know, writing what the situation was, but also writing what was it like to be on the receiving end of me. And then also writing about how I was actually going to make the amends. You know, so I wrote the list, I wrote the situation, I took it to my sponsor, and then I went back and I looked at everybody that I'd caused harm, and I put down what it was like to be in their shoes. And then we went through the list, and we decided how we were going to make each amends. To my children, it was quite difficult because some of them, you know, I hadn't seen in many, many years. So it was about writing letters. Some of it was about making direct amends, actually meeting up with them. And that was painful. Because how do you tell your son that you've neglected, that you've never been there for, that you're sorry, and you want to do the best that you possibly can by giving them love and care and some kind of warmth, and not giving them a role model or a father and just taking that all away and depriving them of their childhood. It's quite a painful thing to do, and I've had to do that with my son, I've had to do that with my daughter, and I've had to write some letters to my other children. I've had to go to the grave to write letters to people and read them out. But the continuous amends is about, amends is not to say sorry, it's to change. It's to restore something to its original self. And I've had to make amends to myself by the way I treat myself, which has been really, really important. The amends are ongoing. You know, the relationship with my mum, my family, you know, all my relationship were about making amends and being consistent and reliable. Somebody who isn't going to let you down and disappoint you, because a lot of my resentments are about people letting me down and disappointing me. I know my time's coming to an end, so it's about rushing through the last three steps. So the amends are ongoing, because my illness is an everyday illness. My recovery is an everyday recovery. The amends to myself is just for today, every day. I make an amends to myself not to pick up. And the most loving thing I can do, if I can on that particular day, is go to a meeting. Maybe phone my sponsor, check in with someone, but stay connected to the fellowship. Step 10 was about, you know, for me, clearing out the wreckage of the present. You know, looking at the resentment, looking at the person, looking at the situation, looking at my part. But the most important thing in the step 10 inventory was about looking at what I'd like to do differently given that situation again. I had to have a solution. I couldn't keep going back to the problem, and I couldn't keep writing down about how defective I was and how flawed I was, because there was no solution. I had to also write down the good things that happened in my inventory process. I had to write about the things that I'd done well in my inventory, because I'm not just the flaw. I had to look at the whole part of me again, that whole thing of being a whole human being. It is ongoing. Step 11 is about making a conscious contact with a God of my understanding, and that's about being connected to myself. If I haven't got any peace of mind or any emotional tranquility, how can I meditate? How can I connect if I'm full of resentment, bitterness, hatred and anger? You know, I have to be clear. And if I'm connected to me and I'm at peace with myself and I'm at ease with the world. And if I'm not at ease with the world. I'm completely disconnected. And prayer and meditation takes many different shapes and forms. The best way to pray is to get on your knees. But what I do is I don't restrict myself or limit myself to just getting on my knees in the morning or in the evening. I can pray and meditate any time. Whenever I need to pray and meditate, I do, because I have to meet my needs. And sometimes it's just about stopping. I have to pray, especially on the underground. You know, I have to stop, think, start again and just pray and hold my breath for 10 seconds just to be guided in what I do next. You know, going into the 12th step is continuous. It's continuous living your life by the other 11 steps and the principles within all those steps and carrying that into every area of my life and trying to be the same person that I am in here, outside in the world and at work and in my relationships with my friends, my family, my sponsor, my sponsees, you know, my colleagues. It's that thing of having that, being consistent. You know, the 12th step is an amazing step because it's one of attraction and it's not promotion. People admire you by your actions, not what you say. It's how you live your life. It's no point levitating off the chair and then getting out in the car and then abusing people, you know, as they cut you up. The 12th step is just about carrying the message and passing it on. And that's all we've got. We just pass it on. You know, it's a bit like the marathon. You know, you run around 400 metres and then you pass the baton. But the thing is, you wait, you come back to a meeting and the baton gets passed back to you. Because we've got a disease of forgetfulness, we forget all this information that we get in here and it gets wiped out. And we have to come round and pick up the baton once again. You know, when I was away, because the first few years of my recovery, I was actually in an institution in Wandsworth Prison. And I used to listen to a lot of tapes, and I couldn't get to meetings because we'd have one meeting a month. But the tapes come to me. It's like, what's that thing, Muhammad going to the mountain, or the mountain coming to Muhammad? Anyway, the tapes found their way to me. And what it was an act of love. It was an act of kindness and generosity that was given to me by other people who cared enough in the fellowship to carry the message to me. And some of them don't even know they carried the message to me. And I've heard it said a lot recently, but when I was in jail, there was a guy called Tim M. And Paul knows him, and a few other people know him from Hampstead. And I've never forgot that saying. He said, the heavens fall silent each time a newcomer walks into the room because a human being has been restored to dignity. And I've got so much dignity. I am a decent human being. I am a proud man. I'm a proud husband, father, parent, colleague, sponsor, sponsee. I am enough, and I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks, Andrea. Are there any NA-related announcements?
Yeah, my name's Charlie, and I'm an ally. Hi. I'm the secretary for this meeting. Blue books are free if you're in your first 30 days. Literature is free in your first 90 days. There's no charge there afterwards. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, hi, everyone. Frankie. I've got some tickets for this Barnes of Bucks Reads called Secret, The Secret History of Dance. It's on the 25th of November. The tickets are £5, but if you've got a fee ring within like 90 days, then you have one for free. If you like one of these tickets, say 25th of November, from 8 to 2 a.m. I don't know what the music is, but it's meant to be very varied.
Thanks, Frankie. Hi, Paul.
I'm a newcomer representative for this meeting, and what that actually means is that if you're a newcomer or need sponsorship or need to be put in touch with a sponsor, come and see me afterwards and I'll take your number. And if also you want to sponsor people and you work in the steps and all the rest of it, come and see me afterwards and I'll take your name as well. I'll try and match some people up with some people in recovery.
Thanks, Paul. JD?
Yeah, I'm JD, and I'm the CD secretary for this meeting. Like I said before the break, CDs, you can have one free if you're in your first 30 days. Thereafter, they're £2 each.
Thanks.
Okay, right. Andrew, you're going to do the start the clean time countdown. I think we'll start with an 11-year one.
there anyone here who has multiple years of recovery today or this week?